Hello, everybody. Merry McAllister McLeanmas to Christmas Harder. If we did the scheduling right, that you're seeing this, maybe you're unboxing this on Christmas Eve, maybe you're seeing it on Christmas Day, maybe you're seeing it in the week between. But this is the big gift, the big surprise movie gift. It is the 1983 film A Christmas Story, directed by Bob Clark, written by Jean Shepherd, starring Melinda Ruth Dillon, Darren McGavin, Peter Billingsley. I love this movie. I've seen this movie like 20 times. This movie is there's a lot of my life in this movie, but since it's a Christmas movie, there's a lot of this movie that's not my life. I'm already three sheets to the wind because we just got done with one of our boozy drunken lunches, the first one.
Yep.
Of the Christmas season. So I love this movie. I think it's amazing. Jim, I was like most of the way through our live watch before I realized you hadn't seen this movie as many times as me. I thought you were just like super drunk and like forgetting things.
I mean,
like,
I certainly was that. But yeah. So, growing up as a witness, I wasn't able to watch this movie in its entirety, and I'd catch pieces of it here and there because you couldn't avoid it, right? Like, even if you're Jehovah's Witness, you would have to throw your TV out and buy a new one in January to avoid seeing this movie. And now it's even worse. Like, they play on two stations, they play 24-hour marathons of this leading up to Christmas and Thanksgiving. So, like, there's no way you escape seeing some of this movie. And, like, the flagpole scene, the Santa Claus scene, like, all of those things are things I vividly remember seeing.
Yeah.
But a good chunk of this movie, I had forgotten.
It's a modern day, it's very similar to like a modern day, or I guess not modern day, like the last 15 years of It's a Wonderful Life. Because, you know, Wonderful Life was one of these weird kind of outside, it's in common domain, so people could, or public domain, so people could, you know, broadcast it for free, and people like kind of ran it to the ground. And I feel like A Christmas Story is on its way. So the first time I saw this, I was like 24. And I was just flipping through the channels, and I came across this movie because, you know, I was a Jehovah's Witness, and I wasn't particularly fond of Christmas movies. Mm-hmm. But what drew me in was this the scene of this old man reacting to his furnace acting up and doing this kind of like balder eyes swearing, like, "Gar darn gar store war." And I remember seeing or hearing Ralphie say,
"In the heat of battle, my father wove a tapestry of obscenity that, as far as we know, is still hanging in space over Lake Michigan."
I'm like, Jesus Christ, that's my dad. Because, you know, I grew up as a Jehovah's Witness. My mom is very straight-laced, but my dad was never converted. So my dad was this like endless engine of profanity, and I immediately like stopped what I was doing and started watching this film and fell in love with it. I told my brother and sister about it. You know, we kind of watched it and talked about it ourselves. And then, you know, a couple years later, I was out of the organization and I started like, I'd watch this 2, 3, 4 times a year. Mm-hmm. Easy.
This is like the Christmas version of Groundhog Day. I could watch this anytime it comes on.
Yeah. Yeah. And any part of the movie that you start, you're there. And I kind of ran it into the ground. I watched it 20 times in the space of like 6 years, and I got a little sick of it. And this live watch was probably the first time in 3 years. Cause I remember sitting down and watching it with Jack about when he was like 9. So that's about four or five years ago. And I haven't seen it since. It still holds up. It's still an amazing film. This is like your third time seeing it?
All the way through, probably.
So what's your thoughts?
I mean, I agree. I think this is a Christmas classic, although it wasn't an instant Christmas classic. It was pretty close to that. It's a modern Christmas classic. Mm-hmm. If you can say the 1983 is modern.
Yeah.
It's more modern than a lot of Christmas classics. Sorry, I'm a little drunk.
I mean, yeah. You got Elf, like that's another, like the modern Christmas, like a lot of people have a lot of affection for like the Muppets Christmas Carol.
Sure.
You've got
Scrooged. This is in the same, you speak of these the movies all in the same hushed tone, right? Like these are the revered movies of Christmas nowadays.
And what I really love about it is that it was also set in Indiana. Now this is kind of like, this is set in Holman, Indiana, which is kind of a stand-in for Hammond, Indiana, which is nestled right between Chicago and Gary. Yeah. So it's kind of the shitty You know, on the Lake
Far
Michigan,
north, yeah.
It's a like a steel town or a founder, and there's very mixed. You know, you got like middle class people living with like lower class people, and mm-hmm. that felt a lot like Mooresville. You know, because we were, you know, like you get in those rural communities. This was a rural community, but like I imagine back in the 30s or 40s, this takes place that like property zoning wasn't as strong as it used to be. So mm-hmm. maybe you'd have a junkyard right next to your middle class house,
or your yard would be a junkyard, as you see in this movie a couple.
Your yard wouldn't be a junkyard. Yeah. And kind of like the way kids, like I grew up in a neighborhood where kids were allowed to kind of roam free, yep. and people, like parents.
I was
kinda
on my bike every afternoon after school, all by myself or with my little brother who was 2 years younger.
Yep,
we just roamed the streets on bikes.
And you, this is like I don't know what kid culture looks like nowadays, because I feel like it's more online, and it's more of like in Discord chats and like in PlayStation parties and stuff. But like this. There was a kid culture where parents would just turn you out and you kind of roamed, and you had these like free associations, and people mm-hmm. were bullied and
get home by dinner
you
or
get
by
home,
dark.
As long as you got home by dinner, there weren't any problems. And I just love that it's set in like the Midwest, and which I think privately is the like ground zero for Christmas. I mean, mm-hmm. I think the Northeast can probably lay a claim to that too.
Yep.
Maybe the Rockies, probably the Plain States.
Anywhere it snows.
Anywhere,
is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. If you're south of like Kentucky,
Arizona, get the fuck out
Arizona,
of here.
Arizona, get you're celebrating some counterfeit version of Christmas. Sorry, Australia. Sorry, south of the equator. But yeah,
unless you go real far south.
Yeah, and like it's also interesting because this depicts a period of time that culturally we're stuck in Christmas. Like in a lot of ways. You know, we mythologize and still celebrate the 30s and 40s Christmas. Like, mm-hmm. those are where all the famous Christmas anthems come from. That's where, like, the look of Santa Claus kind of got crystallized by Coca-Cola. You know, it's where you have, like, you know, Ralphie mentions this point where they're all looking in the, what is it, Bigsby's window. It's the...
Higby's, yep.
Like, electric joy. You know, like, you have the...
I think the line is electric sex in reference to the lamp, but... Sure.
Well, there's also a line about like the actual mechanized electronic joy is
okay.
what he said, because okay. you've got like, you know, these are, you know, no, they're not hobby horse toys. They're not like these are like recognizably mass produced, you know, consumer goods. It feels like Christmas. And I wonder for how much longer, because I feel like nowadays kids don't have that kind of shared kid culture. This might seem like almost like me watching Little House on the Prairie. You know, if I'm a modern kid, mm-hmm. that's not allowed to go outside, not allowed to roam neighborhoods.
No, I feel you. I honestly thought this was set more in the 50s when I was watching it on the live watch, but I found out through sort of looking at it that it's the 40s, which kind of surprises me, because I thought that the family car here was a really old car mm-hmm. and was shitty, and therefore it was breaking down, like the tires were popping. It turns out that's probably an actually pretty new car, right?
Huh.
Like,
I don't know. I'm not a car. I'm not an Oldsmobile man, let alone.
I'm just thinking the stuff that was around in the 40s looks a lot like the car they're driving.
Does it?
So it okay. probably wasn't a super old car.
Well, I mean, that's the other thing, is like cars didn't last nearly as long as they do now.
But I'm also thinking like that family, the Parker family, is pretty well off.
So that's the question I had, because when I was watching this, I was trying to figure, like, trying to peg them economically. Like, are they solidly middle class? And
I think so.
And but I kind of think they're in between, or like my family. Like, my family barely made by, but my dad was smart with his money. He really, like, drove older cars and had older appliances that he fixed up himself. He did all the mm-hmm. housework himself. Because, like, you know, They're struggling with car problems. They're struggling with a furnace that barely works. Their house was like an electric fire waiting to happen. Uh-huh. And
however, I will say that the dad takes so much glee in repairing these things that I think even if they had the money to fix them, like professionally, he mm-hmm. wouldn't do it.
Well, see, that's the thing.
Like
is
the
like,
car, he's like, fucking time me. I do this every week. Time me on this tire change.
He's like the Daytona 500. Yeah.
Right. He fights this furnace through the whole thing, uh-huh. and I feel like he gets a joy out of that. That would be lost if he just had it replaced or fixed.
And I've realized in my early 30s that I think I have become my father, because I remember my like being exasperated as a teenager, like, why am I, you know, this is like what, in 95, and like my dad was driving in like an 83 Chevy Celebrity that like was a piece of shit. And it probably had like 115,000 miles on it.
Didn't he give you that Celebrity?
Yeah, that was, I was supposed to get his 85 Mal, like V8 Malibu, and then he wrecked it like 2-3 weeks before I got my driver's license. So I got this Chevy Celebrity. But it's funny because, like, you know, I'm now driving a 2004 Pontiac Vibe, which is what, 16 years old at this point. It's got 285,000 miles on it, and my son is exasperated, like, Jesus Christ, Dad.
A car, Dad.
And I'm like, why do I want a car payment? Yeah. This thing works. And I've got like hand-me-down appliances that I've repaired several times.
I saw
because
what you carved a turkey with this Thanksgiving.
I carved a turkey with my dad's 1974 electric carver. Like,
Westinghouse or something. Yeah,
yeah, I've kind of because, like, why do you want to waste the money? You
absolutely
know? That's you buy a new washer, that's $500 you can't take a vacation with.
And especially if you enjoy the process of fixing these things up, right?
But that's the thing, I don't.
This is a hobby for this dad, though.
But every time I think about buying, like, I've got a fucking toaster oven that I hate. It's 20 years old, but it works flawlessly. And every time I think about just ripping it out of the wall and throwing away, my dad is in the back of my mind, like, well, it's a perfect, it still fucking toasts, and it still fucking ovens. So what are you going to do? You're going to throw it? You're going to spend $65 on another toaster oven to toast just as well? And they're like, I can't do it. I can't do it.
Once it stops toasting correctly, then you throw it out.
Yeah. Like, I pray every time I set it to, you know, I think, like, this is the one. This is the thing's going to kill it. This is the thing that's going to kill it.
Yeah.
But, you know, like, that's the thing. Like, it makes me feel nostalgic for being like, you know, for that experience back, you know, when my family was still united. And, you know, I don't have the Christmas good times, but I divided my notes into, like, kind of general stuff. Christmas as a kid, Christmas as an adult, and then, like, the dad, and then kid shit. Because and honestly, the kid shit is, like, the longest part of the outline, because a lot of this stuff is, like, not tied to Christmas. Yeah. It just happens to happen around Christmas. The bullying, the stuff that goes on to school, the relationship with the brother, all that, you know, the daring your friends to do stupid stuff like that is not necessarily Christmas, but it's stuff I really relate to.
Yeah, same here. That's the thing that gets me about this movie every time, is just the atmosphere that these kids live in. And I know it's the 40s, and it's 40 years before I was even born, but I still feel a lot of the 80s in this movie. And I think, you know, it's a product of its time, obviously. I think a lot of the way the story is told really leans into that. You know, you get this adult sort of narrating the whole thing, and he's talking about the things that maybe he wasn't thinking as a kid, but now he understands to have been true in his mind. Because, like, there's a lot of stuff that I don't remember about being a kid, but now that I look back on it as an adult, I go, that must be what I was thinking when I was doing these things.
It's such a brilliant conceit for the movie, right? Because a lot of times adults look at kids and think how stupid they are. You know, there's like a subreddit called Kids Are Fucking Stupid, but, like, you didn't think that at the time. And what I love about this is, like, a modern, like, this guy's narration is giving this the same, like, giving the double dog dare situation the same attention that a historian would give, like, the execution of, or the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand, right?
Sure.
Like, oh, this is a major breach of etiquette, and Flick was left unable to do anything but put his tongue on the flagpole. And
especially when he drops an F-bomb. Right? It feels like the start of World War I.
There we go.
Dan! Oh, for one brief moment, I saw all the bolts silhouetted against the lights of the traffic, and then they were gone.
Oh, fudge.
Yes, yeah. And the way he, like, he takes it with an adult seriousness, this kid culture, because, you know, I think, you know, like, we've been talking about the Mr. Rogers stuff. Like, you know, kid culture is serious to kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a unique voice that this film has.
And it ages really well, too. Like, I was fucking riding my bike and slamming pogs, but, like, all of the things of being a child are still the same.
Yeah.
I don't know if that holds true now, but
that's the thing.
It did in the 80s.
I wonder if this generation, you know, like the Zoomers growing up, I don't know about the millennials. They might still, like, Gen Xers for
sure. I am a millennial, so
You're the world's oldest millennial, though.
The oldest one that exists, yeah.
I wonder if it'll still be true. Or because, like, the other thing is, like, there's a total lack of cynicism here in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's nothing, like, you know, I think modern Christmas movies, when I think of, like, Polar Express, when I think of Elf, it's all about, like, all the reasons you don't believe.
Yeah, and consumerism, and, yeah.
And they address that a little bit in the film, like, you know, Ralphie says,
let's face it, most of us were scoffers, but moments before zero hour, it did not pay to take chances.
It's kind of like atheists in a foxhole. There's no atheist in it. He's like, but on the night before D-Day, you know, you dug down and you found that belief. I thought that's really funny, too.
Should we talk about the film and the making of it and stuff like that? Because
let's do it.
I read a lot of the history of this movie, and apparently it was written... Well, it was adapted from a work by a man named John Shepard, or Gene Shepard, probably Gene. And he was like a pretty famous radio and television host from the 60s.
He sounded like, from the descriptions, he's like a Garrison Keillor type.
Enlighten me.
NPR, Lake Wobegon.
Keep going.
What was that? This American Life.
Okay, there we go.
Poet. Didn't he have like a poet's corner? Like, he's got that, like, he's that type of personality.
That's right. That's his name.
What's that guy in 60 Minutes, like an Andy Rooney type? Uh-huh. He's just a personality. He spins tales of Americana.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's very much what this novel that he wrote was. It was a collection of sort of semi-autobiographical.
In God We Trust, All Others Pay Cash.
Yes.
Yeah.
It was semi-autobiographical, right? Meaning there were a lot of embellishments, that, which you can feel in this movie. A lot of these things almost certainly didn't happen this way. You don't have a pack of hound dogs running through the house, because the first time that happens, you learn to keep the fucking door shut. But, you know, it gives it a fantasy sort of feel, right? Like, a lot of Christmas movies have that sort of not quite lifelike feel to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think this sort of, like, weird Americana stuff does in this movie.
Yeah, it's like if you're a 50-year-old man thinking about your Christmases, I imagine, because when I think about my summers, like, all my preschool and elementary summers kind of, like, blend into one big orgy of swimming pools and sandboxes and going to see my family and the Gulf Shores, Alabama, and you know, going and spending the days down at my granddad's farm. And I can't pick out, like, which were the memories were when I was 5 and which one were 9. And I can easily see that this could be kind of like an amalgam of, like, 3 different Christmases that he's kind of hazily piecing together.
Which is so great, because it kind of hits a lot of people's Christmases, right?
Yeah.
Like, it hits, you know, certainly not Jehovah's Witness Christmas, but it does hit even those family elements.
Sure.
Of people who don't celebrate Christmas.
Sure. It was directed by Bob Clark, who, like, I didn't recognize any of the other films except for Porky's. Like, one of the most profane, gross 80s comedies. Mm-hmm. And then he also has done one of the most heartwarming, you know, solidly PG family entertainment one. I thought that was wild.
So it's interesting, because there isn't much swearing in this movie, right?
Right.
There's
of the a swearing lot of fake, is like fake swearing.
Yeah, right? There's a lot of grumbling and
oh, fudge.
Right, only I didn't say fudge. Yeah. I said the word. And I guess that was... I don't know if that was in the script beforehand, but when they went to find a location for a department store where they could look in the window and they could see the display, right? And they could sort of check out this Red Ryder at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
They searched and searched and searched, and nobody would fucking let them do it. And I don't know why.
Huh.
And then they finally came to Higbee's, which is a real corporation, and they said, yes, you can do it, but we want to be able to have some editorial control over the swearing in this movie.
Hmm.
And I don't know if that's because it started out with a lot of swearing.
I could see
via the
old
dad.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
Yeah, or if it didn't end up having that much swearing and they didn't have to do that much to it.
Right.
I don't know. It's weird.
I mean, it's one of those things where, like, the limitation might have made it stronger, because I actually think, you know, the bolderized version is really funny.
Like, it the old is, man,
not a frickin' frackin'.
I can't picture this movie if every other word was fuck out of that dad's mouth. Like,
sure.
That wouldn't feel right.
Yeah, if it's like...
It wouldn't feel magical. It wouldn't feel whimsical.
Yeah.
It would feel a little crass.
Sure.
A little it's a little gross.
Yeah.
Which is what we specialize here.
It is. You mentioned like being in the 30s and 40s because it's like before I really started, because like, you know, I watched the movie like 20 times and there's a couple things I picked out that, you know, when you actually look at it like critically, you start noticing some things, because I always assumed it was like kind of a 50s Christmas. But like when I was looking, I'm like, oh, there's a couple American servicemen and women like wearing World War II uniforms, like they're, you know, maybe just about to go ship off, or maybe they got Christmas leave. There's Wizard of Oz everywhere, which came out in 38 or 39. Mm-hmm. And it really kind of like sets it in that period, which I thought was cool and I never kind of noticed before. And also, did you know that Gene Shepard is in this movie?
Yeah, he's the guy in the mall who tells Ralphie.
Hey, kid, just where do you think you're going?
I have to see Santa. Oh,
the line ends here. It begins there.
He's the narrator, and he's also the guy that says, hey, kid, where do you think you're going? And makes him get in the back of the line, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Actually, all of the writers, right? The three people who worked on the writing of this film
are in the movie.
So Bob Clark, I think, is the guy who, when he goes out to view the lamp from the street.
Hey, Parker, what is that? Don't bother me now, sweetie. Can't see I'm busy.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, he won it. It's a major award. Yeah.
Is the Christmas tree guy one of them? The Christmas tree lot salesman?
No, the other one is actually Gene Shepard's wife, who is also in the same scene that he's in. She's just
On the sidewalk.
She doesn't get
too.
Any lines because probably she's a woman. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. It's 1983.
Women don't get lines in movies.
Only the moms. Only the moms and teachers.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff we could talk about.
1939.
With the family and the weird nature of like the relationships there, but I'm sure we'll get there.
I want to talk about some of this. Before we get to Christmas stuff, I guess I want to talk about kind of some of the kid stuff. The pointless fights of brothers. Like several points in the movie, there's like a pecking order about, like, you know, Ralphie and what's his brother?
Randy.
Is Randy. Yeah. Ralphie and Randy. They're like wanting to use the bathroom, or they're wanting to get to the dressing, the dresser, or they're wanting
to get to bed first,
or they're wanting to get to the packages, and like the older brother's just kind of throwing the kid brother out of the way. Mm-hmm. Now, my sister was about 7 years younger than me, and then she and my brother were like 2 years apart.
Okay.
So at no point did I ever think it was appropriate for me to like physically manhandle my brother and sister. I was always much older and stronger than them. I know you and your brother were like a year or two apart. Did you relate to any of this kind of like constant vying for dominance and struggle?
Not constant, but definitely it was there.
Like,
for sure. I remember just a few scuffles that my brother and I had, but I think for the most part we got along pretty well.
Because I remember like when my brother and sister were like Ralphie's age, I was like 15 or 16, I'm like, this is insane shit you guys are. I was I was kind of like a junior authority figure at the time, like, you know, I was kind of like,
well, you're probably home with them a lot when
I was made responsible for making sure they're doing their chores and stuff, and I'm like, the shit that you guys are getting into is like such petty nonsense. I don't understand. But another thing I personally related to is like Ralphie's fantasizing about like, oh, if I get the BB gun, I can protect my family from like grizzly bears or bad guys. And I remember thinking that, and I had like, my dad got me a BB gun when I was 7, I think. Mm-hmm. And I'd always like, I had a, like a Bowie, like a big Bowie knife. It was handed down from my grandfather when I was like 6 or 7. I had like an array of like honest to God weaponry. And I remember thinking the same, like, you know, like I keep it by my bed because who knows? And I saw my son doing the same shit with like, you know, when he had Nerf guns, he'd be like, oh, you know, like he wanted to keep him close in case a bad guy came. Or when he got a pocket knife, it's kind of like, I'm going to keep it by my bedside drawer. Did you ever have any of that kind of like...
Oh, yeah. This is why Home Alone works, right? Like, you think you could do anything.
Yeah.
Like, if fucking Saddam Hussein invaded the U.S. and tried to take your house, you would fend him off.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. All right.
I think every kid does this, right?
So what was your weapons dash?
So we mostly had a lot of stick based stuff. So we were building like shields out of sticks, obviously swords out of sticks, and arrows and shit like that. Yeah,
I remember even like one time my dad helped me build a snow fort because there was like a particular type of like packed, and he went out there with a shovel and cut like igloo blocks. There was 12 inches of snow on the ground. Damn. And helped me stack them up and made like, you know, shoulder high kid fort.
And then made you sleep in it.
Yeah, I had to live the rest of the winter out there. Right.
Until you earn enough money to pay your part of the rent.
Right, but it's one of those things, like, because my dad is always one of those guys that, like, you know, went out and, like, played with us kids in the yard, and he was, like, the neighborhood dad, you know, like, a lot. So, like, all the neighborhood kids see we're doing this thing. So now, like, all of us neighborhood kids are like, okay, well, now what we got to do is we got to stock the fort. We got to get, like, all these snowballs put together, because who knows, like, what if some other strange kid?
What if Scut Farkas?
Yeah, what if a Scut Farkas came up? So we'd like stockpile all this shit, and like it's like maybe that's where I get my little bit of a, I got like the eeniest, teeniest bit of prepper in me.
Yeah, we had in one of our houses, we had a clubhouse in the back, like a combination like playground slash clubhouse sort of thing, and we use that thing. Is this 2-story like? Solid wood.
I had the same thing. My dad.
Thing, yeah.
It was a play fort on top and a sandbox on the bottom. Yep. And then it had like an attached swing set.
And slide. And,
it was the base. It was the base.
We used it like one. We felt like that was our castle.
There was like 2 or 3 kids in my neighborhood that had those like that. And it was always like, you know, it's like we had these different mobile command centers. Mm-hmm. But I loved it. Like the thing I thought was funny is like what kids back then thought were cool, like when Ralphie comes in as his like, you know, Red Rider superhero, he's wearing this like sequined bejeweled,
oh god,
like he looks like some kind of like shining god.
He looks like Michael J. Fox looks in Back to the Future
3.
Back to the Future
3, this the Wild West one, right?
Yeah,
when he was like kind of came out as
it's got to be Back to the Future 3. Yeah,
yeah, he looked like a cowboy dandy.
Yeah.
But like, you know, him killing Black Bart and his band, and they got like these ludicrous X's over their eyes.
Oh no, it's all blue. Right.
Yeah. I fucking loved it. I also related to like, cause I don't know, maybe my mom did this with me. But I remember my brother and sister getting, you know, cause again, by the time they were old enough to, I started remembering them going out and doing stuff. They'd always get like super bundled up, and my mom didn't give a shit with me. It's like, you know, she wasn't checking to see if I was going out with hats and gloves and all that kind of stuff. But Ralphie's little brother, Randy, getting bundled up to the point where he can't even move.
I love Randy through this entire movie. He's maybe my favorite character of the entire thing.
He's
next
very
to maybe
cute.
The dad, but like relentlessly cute, and he's put in situations that are just.
Right.
Designed for comedy.
Yeah.
And that dressing scene is so good.
Yeah.
I never experienced this as a kid because we grew up in San Diego. There's no fucking reason to ever bundle up.
Sure.
But like, I understand how that would suck.
Yeah.
And how the parent would feel like it's necessary.
Sure.
And just like him screaming and the scarf on his face, and I take it off. I can't.
The comic tension
down.
Of him screaming, and she's wrapped him up like a mummy, and then she has to unwrap him just to hear. It's like, I can't put my arms down.
And then he falls in the snow, and he's like, I can't get up.
Kid does a pretty good job of physically acting that stuff out.
Oh yeah,
I thought.
Oh yeah,
I thought it's really funny. Mm-hmm. I love, because here's the thing that I can't really relate to, like the relationship the kids had with the teacher.
Yeah, I never had any kind of relationship with.
Yeah, like the idea
like
that we would all like do a prank on the teacher, or she'd have a drawer full of like you know, these back of the comic book pranks that she's collected. Like that was, you know, like we were a lot more buttoned down as children, I guess. I don't know, maybe this is like the town we lived in or our socioeconomic status, but like the idea
just school in general changing.
Yeah.
Like it feels nowadays that school is less of like a camaraderie between teachers and students, and more of like a competition to see if the teachers can actually get the fucking students to do what they're there to do.
Right, right. But I thought like, you know, her confiscating all the fake teeth, I'm like,
first, gross.
She has all the diseases now.
Yeah, I don't want drool on my hands at any point, and the drool of 40 kids. No, thank you.
Let's talk about the tongue freezing on the flagpole.
Yeah, the iconic scene, right? Like, this is the number one iconic scene from this entire film?
Yes.
Okay.
I had a friend that did this in school. He put his tongue, like, in the middle of January on the tetherball pole. at Neil A. Armstrong Elementary School in Mooresville, Indiana.
I played on that same tetherball court.
I'm sure you did.
Tetherball pole.
He froze his fucking tongue to that pole. Now, we didn't get to the teacher. He actually just pulled it off. And I remember this postage size stamp of skin that was frozen to the pole and his tongue bleeding and shit and him.
That's awful.
Yeah.
What the fuck is wrong with the fire department? They just grab his head and yank.
Right?
Can't you get hot water? Can't you get... you've got a truck full of water there. Just douse the kid.
Piss in his mouth. Something.
Well.
Maybe that's a little too far.
Yeah.
But I think the way these kids played this dare, double dog dare, triple dog dare, the way what was it, Flick, his eyes kind of widened when the kid hit him with the triple dog dare, and how he kind of squared his shoulders and kind of loosened up for because he put himself in a situation where he called his old man an idiot, and he's you don't know what he's doing, it's not going to work. And he comes in, his tongue's bandaged. I love that.
They must have stuck this kid's tongue to the pole somehow. Really stuck it to the pole.
I thought so, too. Do you know what they did? They drilled a hole, and they hooked it up to a vacuum pump. So when he put his tongue there, it sucked it in and made it look like it was stuck. And I'm like, oh, that's of course. Now, what's Ralphie's name? Peter Billingsley. Mm-hmm. He said he told a tall tale, I think, at some kind of con where the crew left because I guess this kid was being a brat that he left them there hooked up to the pump for a lunch break. I'm like, I don't buy it. I think Peter Billingsley was playing to the audience.
It
but
was probably a joke where they turned around and said, okay, bye, see you later. And then they immediately turned around and let him loose.
But what a great way to do that. I mean, it looks exactly like it, and they'll shoot it from the side so you can't see the hole. I was pretty wondering.
I thought maybe they let him stick his tongue to this and just have the water ready to get it off there painlessly, but okay, that's a really good solution.
But also I love the insight into kid culture about the teacher saying, I'm sure whoever put him up to, first of all, why would you get in trouble for putting a kid up to doing something this stupid? Mm-hmm. You know, he's got his agency, right? No one put a gun to his head. He was triple dog dared. Mm-hmm. But the idea that a kid would suffer from guilt instead of suffering from punishment, right. I love that.
Adults love to say things like that, but kids know better. We knew darn well it was always better not to get caught.
But I thought it was great. Mm-hmm. Would you like to talk about Scott Fargus?
Oh, I want to say so much about Scott Farkas.
Scott Farkas was a rough-looking young man, and it must be said that this actor, I looked him up, he grew up into be a fairly good-looking adult.
If not still rough-looking.
Yeah. We 2 years ago, he was had a minor part in American Horror Story, and I remember someone pointing him out. He looks like a Partridge fan, like a Cassidy.
Really?
As an adult,
I think Scott Farkas looks like a teenage Rorschach. Scott Farkas. Well, his name is Scott.
Yeah, that's not great.
It's not even... Scott that's Farkas not a 40s name. Homeless. That's just a fuck you name.
Scott Farkas is a homeless boy.
He has to be. He's never shown going to school. He doesn't have parents, as best I can tell.
Yeah. Him and Oliver Twist just hangs out in the alleys of Hammond, Indiana... Slumming and Gary,
Scott Farkas was born to the streets.
He was.
He was maybe named by the streets.
He was Rorschach. Prove me wrong that 1985, that he didn't turn into a costumed, insane crime fighter.
Yeah.
I don't think you can. It tracks.
Absolutely.
Yellow eyes, so help me God.
Yeah, okay, here's the thing about Scott Farkas. I feel like Scott is doing himself no favors with his outfit. He's wearing a leather jacket, which I feel like is an anachronism for the time. Do you think a teenage kid, a punk, would be wearing a leather jacket in the early 40s?
I don't know.
I thought that was more of a 50s thing.
What? Because, I thought that was the reason that got popularized is because of World War II, bomber jacket guys coming, fighter pilots coming back and popularizing that look.
It seemed a little early for the leather jacket. So he's a fucking dirtbag trendsetter to begin with. But when he takes his hat off, he actually looks like five times better.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah,
and I think once he gets those braces off, he's going to be a fine-looking young man.
That's the argument about him not being homeless. That's a guy about he's got full brace orthodontia. That's expensive. Maybe that's why he is homeless. The parents could afford either they could afford shelter.
They went to him and they asked him. Scott,
you want a room or board or your teeth to be straight, kid?
Yeah, your family can have a home or you can have straight teeth. And he said, "My name is Scott. Fuck you." And
Scott,
he said, "We're living on the streets."
You
did this to yourself, mom and dad.
Ralphie.
Wait. Okay. So
we're not done talking about Scott. Scott, gotcha.
We got to talk about Scott. We did talk about Scott, but I want to talk about the names in this show.
Okay.
Names
you got
in this
Scott.
Movie.
You got Flick.
You got Flick. You got, what is it, like Gordon Dill or something like mm-hmm. that? His sidekick.
Gordo? His first name. Was it Gordo? What they called him Gordo?
His last name's Dill. Which is a bad name. And then the next door neighbor who has all the dogs is named Bumpus.
Bumpus, yeah.
I love the names in this movie. Like, from the bad to the silly, I love them all.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, and I identify with this neighborhood to where, like, you know, you'd have some nice houses and you'd have some houses that have junk cars in it. I mean, that's like fucking Mooresville, man.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, like, you know, our family thing was we don't live like the other white trash. Like, that was like something that, like, my mom and dad were big on. Like, you know, we might not have money too, but like, hey, we're not going to do ignorant shit out here. We're going to make sure our lawns are mowed and well trimmed, and we're going to like do some paint and stuff. And we're not going to let, even though my dad drove a rusted out Datsun, it was never going to be up on blocks in the driveway. But we had a couple neighbors that did. Yeah, I don't know, because my neighborhood had a literal train tracks that ran through it, and some of those houses against the train tracks were pretty rough. There might have been a couple of rusted vehicles involved, but
And then you have people with, like, immaculately cared for lawns.
Yeah. You definitely had people that took pride of ownership and people that didn't, and, you know, I've
all
often found that pride of ownership is tied to your material wealth, because, like, sometimes I think people don't like to live in rundown houses. They just can't afford the maintenance of it. But I identified with these. Do we want to rag on Scott? Do you want to talk about the chief bullying incident, where the tables were turned, the Ender Wiggins incident?
Fight?
Yeah.
Where Ralphie just curses up a storm.
Yeah.
Has his mom's got his back.
He found his backbone and he beat the shit out of his bully. And now I will say that, like, he really not that I feel overly bad for Scott Fargus, and there's like his friends Flick and Gordo. Like, I think Flick especially had a black eye from an earlier bullying. Mm-hmm. And there's this brilliant scene where, like, Flick kind of looks at him and goes like, "Huh," you know, before he's like, "Huh, the bully got bullied." But yeah. Ralphie fucked Flick or Scott up, man,
for like 5 to 10 minutes. He's
blood
just
streaming down the guy's
him.
Face.
Yeah, enough time for this kid who can't put his arms down to run home,
get
their mom. Come back. Like, it's a good several minutes.
It goes on for a long time. Yeah.
And there's a crowd gathering.
Yeah. He tapped his deep well of rage. And it's like, I love how they build it up, because this is also where he was like at the low point narratively. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it was before he came up with the idea to appeal to the big man. Mm-hmm. His teacher had just, you know, like, his big plan to get an A++++ on his essay had gotten shot down with a C- P.S. You'll shoot your eye out.
Yep.
And like, the bully hit him at the right time, and he whooped his ass.
Hit him at the wrong time.
But the more I see it, the more I feel kind of sorry for Scott, because the beating does go. It's a legendary beating.
Yeah.
So
it is.
Do we want to talk about Randy? Because I like the mom's strategy to get Randy to eat.
How do the little piggies go?
That's right. Oink, oink.
I can relate to this too, because there was a summer where my brother, I think he was 4, and I think my mom was lazy by this time. My brother would only eat hamburger buns that had ketchup on it.
Oh.
So he had a he called them ketchup sandwiches, and I think he spent an entire summer eating them.
I mean, I ate mayonnaise sandwiches as a kid.
Did you really?
Mayonnaise and bread, yeah.
Holy fuck. Okay, well, you're my brother's brother from another mother.
It wasn't exclusive. I wouldn't only eat those, but...
No, my mom would make him eat dinner, but, like, yeah, my brother, like, I don't understand, because my brother eventually grew to be, like, 6'7" and 320 pounds. Like, he's a mountain of a man, but, like...
That'll teach you ketchup and
I don't know how you
buns.
Get that way when you're eating ketchup buns, but, like, this idea of a kid that won't eat and, like, the things that you, like...
This is a short-term play by the mother, and it's a long-term catastrophe. Because now you've just told this kid that the only way... This kid just grows to expect that I can eat like a pig. I can eat like this for the rest of my days, right?
It's true.
Like, yes, this works one evening at dinner, but what about the next evening? Are you gonna be wiping this kid's face down every single evening and having the dad peer over the paper, going, "My family is a fucking
it's a
catastrophe."
Not that, but as I watch it, I'm thinking, like, this kid is literally inhaling his food. He's going to choke to death. Like, how do you eat as the same time you're going?
They're snorting.
Like, you know, like that's just, you've got the windpipe and the food pipe right there.
Oh yeah,
you're going to have yeah.
That meatloaf's going.
That's pretty crazy. I want to talk about Orphan Annie and Secret Dakota Rings. Why do companies do this? Because kids are smart. And if they had done, like, I was thinking, like, all the things they could have done, like what kind of messages they could give to make this kid, like, loyal to this brand for life. Mm-hmm. And instead, they exhort him to do the thing that he's done against his will just to join the secret club.
Drink your Ovaltine. Ovaltine? A crummy commercial?
Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you go through this intense, you get jumped into the gang, you get the shit beat out of you, and then your prize for getting jumped into the gang is getting the jumped again. You know, like drink more. I don't...
Yeah, it's a bad payoff.
Yeah, but I did love this shit, and they don't do this anymore. Like, when I was a kid, I don't know if you remember this, but, like, there was one summer where Captain Crunch went missing. Like, on the box of Captain Crunch was just an outline, a dashed outline.
Yes.
Where he had been, and you had to get, like, a red cellophane thing and decode the box top and figure out where he was, and there was a treasure map. And that shit was super fucking fun. And you could, like, win a prize and all that stuff. I don't understand, like, why you would set the kids up for that much kind of failure. It seems like, I don't know, but there you go, and, like, no one takes kids seriously.
I mean, the usual things that they would do is, like, oh, collect X amount of UPC codes or whatever, right, and mail them in, and you get something cool.
Yeah.
And I guess he did get something cool, but it's like, it's like if you got you saved up a whole bunch of your Captain Crunch things, or let's say 7-Up cans or something, and you mail them in, and they sent you the NES Spot game.
Yeah.
That game is a piece of shit.
It's a legendarily bad game.
Yeah. Like, that would be the payoff here, right? Uh-huh. Like, that's Ovaltine telling you to drink more Ovaltine.
Yeah. I don't know. I just wish it's such a, like, kids are so impressionable. It's like, yeah, like, if you're going to do something like that, I don't know, maybe we should have a Bald Move Decoder Ring.
That'd be pretty cool.
Like, a club for a club member, and we give them exclusive message, but it'll be stuff like, believe in yourself. You can do,
like,
it.
You subscribe to the club.
Yeah. Get your super secret decoder ring. This is just the entry level decoder ring. This is the bullshit decoder ring. Subscribe for 12 more months to get the exclusive decoder ring where we tell you
and
the
truth.
And that
one will just say, listen to the ad free feeds or the ad placed feeds.
Yeah.
So yeah.
No, that one is where we bullshit. Actually just straight up do commercials. It's like, you know, shave your balls with Manscaped.
I want to talk about the dad while we're on the subject of characters.
Okay, I have a whole section.
Okay, let's talk about the kids first.
Okay, because I only have a couple more kid stuff.
Okay.
Eating soap for punishment for... So this is an issue because, like, I don't know why I didn't struggle with this. When I was a kid, my dad was... I did struggle in one way. I just understood my dad had the license to swear. You know, he could do it with impunity and I couldn't. And that was a clear rule that I understood. What got me in trouble is every once in a while is my dad, when he was yelling at me angrily, sometimes he would bust out a novel string of swears and I would just bust out laughing. Like I remember the first time I heard your ass is going to be grass and I'll be the lawnmower. I was like 11 years old and he was in my face screaming. And that's just the I mean, I'll give it up to my old man. That's a hilarious concept. My ass is grass and he's the lawnmower. That's such a great phrase. And I went like that and I got a savage beating.
Yeah.
This kid, I loved like the way he talks about like,
Now I had heard that word at least 10 times a day from my old man. My father worked in profanity the way other artists might work in oils or clay. It was his true medium, a master.
That's my dad, man. He was a naval corpsman in Vietnam, and he swore like a fucking sailor because he was a fucking sailor. And that's the thing is I do too now. But you got to understand that like I didn't really swear commonly until I was like 18 or 19. I think I started popping my vulgarity swear cherry when I worked at FedEx. Because that was the lingua franca at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning when your flight is delayed and all that. And like you're up to your ass in alligators, like people just fucking swore. And that's where I picked it up. But I really identified with this, but I wasn't like I wouldn't do something stupid like say fuck in front of my dad when I was 9 years old. But
yeah. And it changes the nature of the relationship between Ralphie and his mother when she has his back on that.
Yeah.
Like, she doesn't tell his dad about this string of obscenities as he's beating the shit out of Scott.
He mentions that, like,
from then on, things were different between me and my mother.
I wish I knew exactly what that meant.
Yeah, because it's weird to me, because this entire movie, the kids are deathly afraid of what their father is going to do to them. But you never see the father react extremely to anything, right? I don't know why the kids are so afraid of the father, because the one carrying out the punishments is the mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so like every time the father gets wind of something bad, he takes it to the mother and I presume has a conversation like, we should punish the kids for this. So you go jam a bar of soap in their mouth.
Yeah.
But they're not afraid of the mother. And I don't know how the relationship has changed when she has his back here, because going to the father doesn't ever seem like it's a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, my dad was definitely, because like the thing, I remember my mom using my dad as a threat, like, wait till your dad gets home.
Yeah, but in this movie, it's all implied. It's never.
Yes, like it's never carried out. Once in a while, the dad will be like,
all right, I'll get that kid to eat. Where's my screwdriver and my plumber's helper? I'll open up his mouth and I'll shove it in.
The mom would like,
and he does say like, oh, I'll give you something to cry about.
Right.
Which,
but the mom was always there to be like, I'll handle, you know, they had this kind of like good cop, bad cop relationship. But it's weird because like, my dad certainly had a bad temper, and he was not above giving me a pretty savage beating with a belt or a newspaper, rolled up newspaper. But like, my mom was more the disciplinarian, and my dad was more of like the agent of chaos. Like, because I knew what I could expect from my mom. She was a Jehovah's Witness. Before I even asked, I knew. In fact, I was trained not to ask her things. But dad. You never knew when he would like indulge in some kind of act of random craziness, you know. Like, my dad is a guy that, like, when he would drive home with his family in the car and the streets were covered in snow, he'd pull the emergency brake and start like fucking rock, doing crazy Tokyo drift shit through the neighborhood. And like, I remember one legendary time where he did this coming into our driveway and perfectly fishtailed in our driveway and then fishtailed in our driveway and then fishtailed back to perfectly line up in the two-car garage right next to my mom. My mom was screaming the whole time and us kids in the back were just like in awe. See, my dad, that's like things like that's like they didn't have like a conventional good cop, bad cop. Like, they were both crazy cops, I guess, just in different ways.
Yeah, there's an implication of that here, but we don't really see it.
They're both nurse ratchets, just in different ways.
These children, though, like, I feel like the director has a vendetta against children.
Uh-huh.
Because every single kid in this movie is demented in some way. Like, you look at the kid in the Christmas line, line, with the fucking aviator cap and the goggles and, like,
those goggles are strapped way too
Christmas.
Tight.
Christmas. I like Santa Claus. This, and Randy, as a character, barely knows where he is in any given moment. He does not know what planet he's on. He's staring out into nothing.
Yeah.
Ralphie does the same, but Randy is a demented child.
Uh-huh.
He takes pleasure in acting like a pig. He screams and lets himself on Santa's lap. Like,
uh-huh.
That kid's got some problems. I feel like Ralphie has some problems too. He's constant, like, he's got ADD or something. Mm-hmm. Like,
I think he's just a kid. kids just have a lack of focus, especially around Christmas time.
I guess. But like things they should be focused on, like you give your teacher a gift and then you just stare into the middle distance while she tells you to take your seat for 5 minutes.
Maybe he does have
ADD. And the entire class laughs.
Because that's what I was thinking. Like in those days, like I was thinking,
it
like
wouldn't have been diagnosed. No,
right.
Because
I remember when I was like in sixth grade, my elementary school got like a special ed program for the first time. Mm-hmm. But up until that, like all the special needs kids were just kind of farmed out into the classrooms. And like it was not an uncommon occurrence to see a kid like, you know, like the aviator helmet, like have a meltdown or something. And like class would just screech to a stop until the parent or until the teacher got control of the situation. So it's like, I think that was just it. Like, you know, you had some kids with some screws loose, or maybe they need to be medicated, but the medication hadn't been invented yet. So,
The parents were just like, whatever.
Right. Yeah, he's a little touched.
He'll grow out of it. It's a phase.
Yeah, it's a phase. It's a phase. A kid just goes into a fugue state for 5 minutes when he turns in his assignment, but that's okay.
Kid wants to wear an aviator cap everywhere. It's a phase.
Yeah, it makes him feel good. It's good for his confidence. Whatever. Yeah. Did you want to move on to talking about the dad? Because I would love to talk about the dad.
I love the dad. Next to Randy, this is my favorite character of the movie.
The most feared furnace fighter in northern in Indiana. There's so
and
many
the
great
way that the dude plays him, I don't know his name, but the actor is so good. I mean, all the actors across the board are great.
Darren McGavin. Who's a bit of a heartthrob in his younger years. He was actually 60 years old in this movie.
He was a heartthrob in his younger days?
He was. I looked him up. He's a fucking dreamboat. Yeah. Huh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Didn't do my proper research, apparently. But he plays this line between like comedy and seriousness so perfectly.
Yeah, he's like the patriarch of the family, but also he's dumb, like at least uneducated.
Okay, yeah. I mean, he's dumb thinking he's gonna win this major award, and like,
whereas I feel like the mom is the smart one.
Yeah,
you know, like
she's the glue keeping this fucking family together.
She knows the trivia. She's like, you know,
she's also the one being shit on the entire movie, but.
That's true. I think the mom and dad have a kind of like they kind of shit. They're each other's arch villain. It seems like.
I just think about the scene where they're all sitting down to dinner, the piggy scene, and she serves up the food and she's cooking and everything, and she goes to sit down. And he's like, "Hey, could you give me some more cabbage?"
Mm-hmm.
She like rolls her eyes as she should because it's right fucking behind you, you lazy asshole.
Yeah.
And she has to get up. She's about to take a bite of food.
Uh-huh.
And she's got to get up and let her shit get cold.
He's got to work all day. He had to fight the Bumpus dogs to get
here. Yeah, he's not working.
Know?
He's reading a fucking basketball score, baseball score, whatever he's doing.
He's actually unemployed this entire movie.
He might be.
He's still treating her like a slave.
Yeah, Papa needs that $50,000 major award.
That's right. He's wanting that fucking bowling alley or whatever. There's so many great lines that Ralphie has, or I guess Gene Shepard has, where it's
are
like,
you sure? Because I can't understand a damn thing that Ralphie says this entire movie.
Well, I'm talking about the adult narration.
When
he
says, I want a Red Ryder BB.
No, I want an official Red Ryder carbine. I should do it and get
ready
my
leg
rifle.
Oh, right.
What'd you say, kid?
Yeah, when Santa Claus is kicking him down the... that was unintelligible.
There's a little more of a lisp to that, yeah.
There's a little of that, too. But the lines.
Some men are Baptists, others Catholics. My father was an Oldsmobile man.
Son of a bitch would freeze up in the middle of summer on the equator.
That cracks me up, and I don't know why. It's just really as he's coming in and complaining. It's like I guess it's a little bit of like the Jewish relationship with God, where it's like it's a struggle. You know, like he's like this damn thing would freeze up in July in the equator, and yeah, he's just a crazy man. The way when he wins this major award, he does this little caper. And then he like, so this is one of the things I didn't realize until like the 21st time I watched this movie. I always thought that he got excited and was going to go outside to pick up his major award. And then the dogs like turn him back from the porch. But he's so excited and so magnanimous that he actually offers his leg to the dogs. He's like,
go on, how about you fellas on me? It's my game.
It's so fucking funny.
And then he slams one of their ears in the door.
Yeah, and it's just stuck there. It's like, serves you right, you mangy
fleabags. The thing that struck me about this scene and really said, like, holy shit, things are so much different right now, is this crate that it comes in.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's not cardboard. It is fucking wood.
This thing.
And he opens it with a crowbar and a hammer.
This is not easy opening guarantee from Amazon.
And there's no styrofoam in it. It's like straw or shredded something.
This came straight from the Acme Corporation.
Yeah. I was blown away seeing that.
And then like, oh God, this lamp, I've got one of these, lamps as a Christmas ornament that hang on the tree.
Yeah.
But like the way the kids react, like Ralphie running his hands up it and cupping its ass and the soft glow of electric sex.
Uh-huh.
The dad, I also loved like how all of the outlets are like slightly overloaded. So every time he plugs something in, it's like sparking.
It catches on fire. Catches there on are fire. Flames coming out of that outlet.
The old man can replace fuses quicker than a jackrabbit on a date. He bought him by the gross.
It's funny. And also just like the battle they set up where this guy's so proud. He goes from effortlessly thinking he's going to get some kind of bungalow in a vacation spot to thinking that he might get a bowling alley. He's going to be rich. And then he gets it, and like he talks himself into this fucking lamp being this amazing thing,
right?
That he wants to show off as like this. Yeah, of course you would. It's a major award. You're not gonna put this in your den. You're gonna put it front and center at the mom's reaction, like, you know, well, I'm a 1930s housewife. I can't say no, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have to fight this guerrilla war. It's and oh my God, the father's impotent rage, knowing that she did this on purpose. But what, you know, and he's like. He's like, where's the glue? He says, we don't have any glue. He's like,
you use up all the glue on purpose.
Why?
Then he walks out, not a finger. He's like, I can't pronounce the way he says not a finger.
Not a finger.
Not a finger.
Yeah, not a finger. like the way Sheldon says bazinga on Third Rock from, what? Not Third Rock from the Sun.
The only thing he could manage, not a finger.
Oh my God!
That's so good. And then he buries the thing out back next to the garage.
As the tap softly plays.
I want to know how many Bumpus dogs are buried out there next to it.
The number is not zero because I don't think Bumpus would miss a dog or two. And I think this old man's got an anger problem and ready availability of crowbars and other machinery that he could use to kill dogs with.
There's actually in that scene where he's changing the tire.
Uh-huh.
I felt like there was a little bit of like Danny DeVito's penguin performance in this guy. Like he's over there going, ha!
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like crouching around and
yeah.
And,
uh-huh. Yeah.
Like,
yeah, he's like really getting into the Indy 500 stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also like, because here's another thing about my dad, is this thing where he's like wheeling and dealing with the Christmas tree guy.
Oh.
And he gets something that was probably going to be thrown in for true, but like he's done this whole like elaborate thing. He's like, this is my dad, like, buying anything, buying a car, buying, like, it always took, like, a day and a half. It was never an easy process. He's like, oh, Jesus. And that kind of rubbed off on me, too, because, like, anytime it's a cash-based situation, I'm absolutely going to ask for a 20% discount. Abso-fucking-lutely.
Yeah.
And I'll probably walk away if I don't get 10.
Yeah. Why not?
I mean, it's like, it's easy. Like, the worst they can say is no, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know? I thought this old man's a chump by getting bought off by Twine and the guy tying it to his damn car, but.
Yeah, and I feel like his strategy was a little weird. He's talking about this neighbor who bought this artificial Christmas tree, right? And he's talking about how it looks like pipe cleaners.
Yeah.
Like, shouldn't you be saying how good it looks?
Yeah, that's weird,
like,
too.
Like, oh, we could just go buy this artificial tree.
But
like,
again, I think the
great.
Dad's kind of dumb. Like,
yeah. I think you're right. He's a little dumber than I gave him.
But so was because the thing is it landed on the tree salesman because when
so
he started talking
dumber,
about
yeah.
when he's talking about the artificial, the guy's like, oh, he's going to do that on artificial trees.
Mm-hmm.
And then like the scene of like the dad being, because I remember a lot of times like my brother and sister and me being stuck in a back seat and like fighting, and like my dad just kind of like white knuckling, you know, driving back from our grandparents' house late at night, just white knuckles on the steering wheel.
Were
just
you
like
screaming Christmas carols into his ears?
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
Because Alexis wondered why he wasn't singing with them. And says probably because they're shouting directly into his fucking ears.
He just
he doesn't want
to
encourage his future deafness.
He just wants to go home, fold up the newspaper under his armpit, go into the bathroom for like 30 minutes so he can get some peace and fucking quiet for a little bit.
And grumble about how the fucking, I don't know,
did you see how fucking
team,
ball,
the Bears traded away the fucking shortstop?
Yeah,
I know that's not
Bullfrog.
A bullfrog.
Did you see how fucking bald his tire was when he got it out of the trunk? It looked like a mirrored surface. Like, there was zero tread on that.
They clearly used it a lot.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
Like, he's good at changing
a
tire.
But my dad, that was another thing my dad did. My dad, like, when he, and again, it's probably because we were fucking broke until my mom went back to school when I was a teenager. But, like, he would always do, like, if we needed a tire, he would go to, like, the fucking junkyard and find one, a little bit of tire, the right size, and, like, you know, change it all. He had all the tools and stuff. He did it all himself.
Yeah, why not?
So
changing a tire is pretty easy.
It is. I think
I feel like I could do it.
I think
even more,
you know,
readily than doing an oil change.
Swapping an old tire for an old tire, like, you know, like, and having like a blowout every month or two is a little bit much, but you know.
Oh yeah, yeah. But like, yeah. I don't want to do it, but if it happened, I could.
But also, there's like also scenes like, you know, where his dad's like a chaos agent, because like he's when he leaves the kids at the mall, presumably where he goes and buys a Red Ryder BB gun, he comes back into the scene arm in arm with like the Wizard of Oz crew, skipping in, like, you know, singing. Like, I thought that was kind of fun. And, you know, obviously he's like the one that comes in and buys the gun for him.
Yeah, he's a little silly. He can let loose, I think, when the situation calls for it.
Yeah. Yeah,
like he calls the audible on the Chinese Thanksgiving,
yeah,
or
when
Chinese
the
Christmas dinner.
The Bumpus's dog. I do blame this, because like before this movie was popularized, as a Jehovah's Witness, our tradition was to go see a movie and watch Chinese food, and to go eat Chinese food and watch a movie on Christmas. And I'm not saying we're the only family out there, because we weren't, but like the Chinese buffet was always like maybe 10% full, and there was like maybe a handful of people watching movies.
The best day to go, honestly.
Yeah. And in the last 20 years, it's like every time I've gone to a Chinese buffet, it's been fucking packed, and the Christmas, like it's almost like a summer blockbuster season. There's fucking Star Wars is going to be coming out. The goddamn Cats movie is going to be coming out. I don't know how much stuff is like. There's going to be tons of people out there. It's kind of ruined it for the Jewish and Jehovah's Witness community.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong.
I had a day to ourselves, man.
I feel like this is the only scene that no longer works in this entire movie.
Right.
This is a very cringy scene. Like from these Chinese restaurant workers trying to sing Christmas carols that they intentionally mix up the R's and the L's, like,
so
it's a little cringy.
It's certainly cringy, but I was trying to think of like, I'm not gonna fight saying that it's racist, right? But it's also probably true. Like a 1939 Chinese diner on Christmas Day, these guys trying like their best to entertain this American audience that they don't fully understand, and like the cultural differences, like.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's not accurate. I'm saying you probably wouldn't put
it's like
that
Leonardo
scene in the movie
DiCaprio's
today.
Friend in Titanic saying, arrivederci, goodbye, go to see. It's like, is that racist, or is that like just how shit happened when you're 1914 and you're trying to cross the Atlantic?
This is the eternal question.
You had some colorful folks. Yep. You had some real culture. You had a melting pot in America.
The one thing I like about that scene a lot is that they call this thing a Chinese turkey, which... They say, like, we remembered, like, this is the season that we learned about Chinese turkey. Mm-hmm. And kids would fucking remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you have this duck served up on the table just in full, like, head and everything.
Sure.
And then the guy comes over and he chops it off with a cleaver.
Oh, he wants to do something about
the head?
Kids
would
absolutely
remember this.
Yeah.
And I think it's a brilliant move by the dad to call it Chinese turkey. Because, like, he doesn't want to disappoint his family, right?
Sure,
like,
yeah.
We're still having turkey,
plus,
kids.
Plus, he's a turkey junkie.
It's just a Chinese turkey. Yeah,
he's trying to he's trying to talk himself into it.
They would certainly remember that into adulthood.
Anything else we want to talk about the dad? Because, like, there's also, like, we haven't talked about Christmas as a kid, which is something that we're going to... I barely remember Christmas. I can remember, like, one or two hazily. Because, like I said, I was 5 going on 6 when we stopped celebrating. And you can't probably relate to any of this stuff.
No.
But the idea that Christmas is the entire kid year revolved around is entirely true.
Yeah.
Like, it's this one, like, you know, everybody's got different birthdays, but everybody's going to get massive loot. You know, if you have a nominally Christian background in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, everyone's going to get like the same payday at the same time. It's all wrapped up in the vacation. You come back and you compare, like, what did you get? Oh, you got a Nintendo. Oh, I got a, I thought that was awesome. The whole like Higby store window, decked out. Like, that's cool. Like, in our hometown, we actually have a little, one of the shops that does kind of like this big train, like this massive train and Christmas village display. That's very similar to that.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that you always had, like, something that you wanted really, really badly. It's like, you know, it's like, you know, I hope I'm going to get this like big ticket item. And then it also struck me true as like you trying to, like, if you had something that you knew your parents didn't want you to have, like, I guess in that day it was BB guns, but now it might be like an M rated game.
Okay.
You know, yeah. You're 9 years old and you want Call of Duty,
mm-hmm.
but you don't want your parents to, you know, it's like, you'll shoot up your school.
Right. Or a Metallica album.
Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. Like, it's always like, you know, how do I make sure they know what they want and also smooth over those waters and make the case? And you're 9, so it doesn't really work right. I love like his many failed attempts at like, oh, I want to, you know, I'll put this advertiser in the middle of my mom's like women's magazine. I'll bribe my teacher. I'll drop that, like, my friend has seen grizzly bears prowling the grocery store.
Yeah, his impulse control is not good, I gotta say. But yeah. You're absolutely right. That feels authentic.
And the scene where the teacher gives him a C+ and PSs him, you'll get, she turns into the Wicked Witch of the East.
I have a huge problem with this scene.
That tracks.
That's fine. Yep, great.
Why is the mother in a court jester outfit?
Could not tell you, and it's very disappointing to me that she's not in something funnier, like a flying monkey suit.
Or, like, the straw, like, if you wanted to go with the scarecrows because she didn't have a brain, like, there's a little bit, like, you know, there's a lot of things, I think, a kid's mind, but, like, what is the Joker routine?
Especially because later on in the movie, they do have Wizard of Oz, like, in this parade.
That's clearly why she's the Wicked Witch, yeah.
Right. So why didn't they stick with the theme?
Yeah.
What does the jester have to do with anything?
Nothing. I don't know. Was there a big jester movie that year, 1939/42? I don't know.
Not that I'm aware of.
But there's like the, I also love like him, you know.
Oh, rarely had the words poured from my penny pencil with such feverish fluidity.
Mm-hmm. Such basic prose.
I know.
It's like,
it's so bad.
It's like, this is a theme. It's like essentially four like broken English sentences.
It's basically like, I like Christmas.
Uh-huh.
I want a BB gun. It's really cool. It's that's
and football
all,
and fuck footballs, right? Because they're not
which
BB guns.
Is hilarious, because then let's talk about the Santa Claus scene, which is another super iconic scene.
Yeah,
that I remember from the movie. You know, he gets stuck. He like blanks, and he doesn't know where he is. And he says, "Yeah, I'll take a football when Santa offers him one," which I think is a nice little callback.
Mm-hmm.
But that scene is so well shot. I'm impressed with the cinematography and like just the filmmaking here. Because they use so many different techniques. Like when he goes up to that Santa Claus, it's fucking scary because they're using this POV shot, which is shot with a fisheye lens.
Yep.
And like the colors are a little off and they're spinning him around and it feels disorienting. Like I feel like I'm in Ralphie's head.
And they've said that the adults were like, they're over this. It's 9 o'clock. Right. They want to get out of here. So like that there's that blurred reality where we don't even, from Ralphie's perspective, see this stuff go down.
Yeah.
And then when we get to Ralphie's perspective, it's like these adults like, come on, kid, what the fuck? And they're,
I feel like it was pretty innovative stuff for the time.
It's the guy that did Porky's. I mean, can you believe it?
God.
But yeah, like, and then he finally gets like this moment of clarity where it's like, I'm blowing my shot. And he this is the hero's journey. Like he puts his hands out and he stops his slide and he claws his way back up there. And he as you say, he says a bunch of gibberish. And Santa Claus translates to speaking in tongues. And he has this blank look on his face. He's like, nah, kid, you'll shoot your eye out. And he puts his boot on his forehead.
Ho,
like,
ho,
this is the big, this was, ho. Yeah, this was the big man himself. This was his one shot. And he gets shut down. Oh, God, it's so funny. It's so good. It's so good.
And then the dad becomes the hero of the movie.
Yep.
He surprises him with the one last gift after disappointing him. Good stuff.
And yeah, because like this was an especially disappointing Christmas because like Ralphie's looking for the gun. He's looking for the gun. He's looking for the gun. He kind of like, it's a kind of half-hearted thing. Like, oh, maybe, but you know, like everyone shut me down. He doesn't find it. He has to be forced to do this pink nightmare, which I think every kid can. I don't know if every kid can, but I can certainly commiserate with getting some unfortunate fashion choices and some, like, anytime you get clothes as a like right. a preteen child, especially, it's a fucking bummer, man. Mm-hmm. Like, what the pajamas?
Which is hilarious because the dad is rooting for clothes. He's like, did I get a tie this year?
Right. Yeah. And I also
wants them.
Like when the mom drops a bowling ball in his lap and like racks him. He's like, oh, but it's Christmas, so what are you going to do? Also, Cecily and I were when I was taking my notes, we're all in on this Christmas morning wine drinking.
Yeah, fuck yeah. Is it wine or port? I couldn't tell.
Ooh, port's
even better.
If they
were drinking fortified wine.
Were we drinking port on Thanksgiving?
We were.
Oh my God, that shit was good. Yeah. I need to get what that was because I want another bottle of it. It was amazing.
Yeah, I'll ask Alexis what it was.
Yeah, yeah.
Find out.
That's going to make Christmas extra special this year. But then, yeah, like when all hope is lost. And like also I thought it was great, pretty good. Like, you know, Ralphie was taking it. He was taking it pretty well. Like, yeah, I had a pretty good Christmas. I didn't get everything I wanted, but he's not like being a shit about it.
I thought you meant after Santa pushed him down the slide.
No.
And I'm like, he's staring at the ceiling.
Yeah, no.
In abject failure.
I love how him and his brother both are just like catatonic.
I mean,
that's
his brother's natural state.
Sure, sure.
But he's dejected, yeah.
Did you have any more Christmas as a kid observations?
No, I'm good.
Because there's also a couple of things about the Christmas as an adult. Actually, we talked about the Chinese restaurant experience, but I've certainly experienced this with my the kids in my family, where you try to engineer a magical experience, like, hey, let's go to this Christmas parade, and the child, you know, because you've got only so many days that, you know, you got in the schedule so many weekends before Christmas where things can happen, and you take it out, and, like, the kid just isn't in the mood for it, and it's kind of like, you know, would you just shut up and enjoy Christmas, goddammit? did you see the magic and whimsy that's happening here? Do you see the light show? This is fucking Santa Claus, like... I like that, like, the Ralphie just, he's so worried. He wants to get to, you know, he's got this pitch to the big man, and his kids, his family's fucking around his lame parade that he sees in probably 4 or 5 years now. And
yeah.
Because that's the thing. I always thought there's some things, like, going through Sharonville Woods that would be, like, a tradition. And it turns out, like, if you do that 2 or 3 times in a row, year in a row, the kids are like, yeah, this is the same shit we've always done. And it's like, ah, yeah, I guess. Yeah. You're growing up. You're getting wise to this stuff, kid.
I mean, that's what tradition is, though. Come on.
Yeah, I think...
kids will appreciate it more when they get older.
Yeah. Plus, it turns out there's, like, 5 light shows in Cincinnati, so you just kind of, like, rotate them around.
Okay.
But, yeah. What else do we want to talk about?
I think that's about all I got.
This is... I don't know if this... Is this my favorite Christmas movie?
It's up there.
Yeah.
Man,
like,
it's way up there.
I like Die Hard. I like Elf. You know, I also like just like, you know, there's a couple things we do like as Christmas traditions. Like I love watching the Community Christmas episodes, the Claymation Christmas episode. I like listening to the Harmontown Christmas episode where the Dicks and Balls and Beer is the episode title.
Always Sunny.
Always Sunny's got an amazing Christmas episode. I like watching the Hallmark shit. But this is. I took a couple years off because I kind of ran it into the ground.
Yeah.
But I think this is going to be one that's going to be nice to get down off the shelf each year. And because it's only like 87 minutes, too. It's a quick watch.
Yeah, it's compact.
Yeah, I this must be why TV shows or TV stations love it, because it's a tight 2 hours with commercials. And you can air 12, you know, you can do a 24-hour marathon. I mean...
And you can rake in 50 million views
probably,
during that period.
Yeah, get all these looky-loos coming
in. I was reading, the some of these viewings get like 4.5 million people watching them.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, they definitely make their money back on that. So that's all I got to say about the movie. I hope you guys enjoyed the live watch. I hope you guys enjoyed this podcast, all of the podcasts that we've done.
Yeah, all of Christmas.
Is a pretty good Bald Move Christmas, I think. I hope you guys did too. Thank you so much for being a club member. I hope you guys all got your Christmas cards or your e-Christmas card if you're an international fan.
Hope you get the Christmas presents you want tomorrow.
I hope you get the Christmas tomorrow,
get
tonight,
Red
whenever, this morning, whenever you're watching this thing. Thanks for being a club member. Can't wait to see what 2020 brings, perhaps clarity of vision. I'll be the first to make the 2020 joke.
Unless you step on your glasses.
That's the thing I want to talk about.
And we're back in the podcast.
Have I told the story that I actually had this experience as an 8-year-old child with
crushing
a BB
your
gun?
Glasses? Oh, it wasn't shooting your eye out.
It wasn't in Christmas. It was in the height of summer. I was bored as shit. And I took my Crossman air rifle, 10-pump air rifle out there. And I was shooting my mom's... laundry, because we had a, like a laundry line, a clothesline.
Shooting your mom's laundry?
Laundry clothesline pole. We had these two metal tees at the back of our yard with lines running in between them, and they were like a round thing. And I like shooting it because I didn't have to set up a target, and I could hear the ping when I hit it, and I knew I was hitting it, and I couldn't damage it. It was a steel pipe. Mm-hmm. And like I was shooting, as I don't know, shooting this like a dozen times. And the other thing I liked is like if you shot a BB gun around noon, you could actually see the, because the BB is this bright brass color, and you could see the BB like actually go and hit the target. And one time I shot it and the stars aligned and this fucking thing went out, ding, and came right back down the barrel and hit me right here in the eye before I wore glasses.
Wow.
I had the exact same reaction as Ralph. He's blinding pain on the ground, dropped my gun. Oh my God, I've shot my eye out. What am I going to do? And then the relief of like, oh my God, I haven't shot my eye out. So it's like when I remember, that's the other thing. When I watched this movie for the first time, I'm like, oh my God, what are the odds? This guy had the exact same thing happen to me. He's shooting a metal target. He wasn't calculating his angles. And, you know, what are the odds?
Guns are dangerous, kids. Even BB guns.
BB guns. That's the thing. No adult supervision.
No.
I was out in the backyard plinking.
Yep.
You know, my mom knew about it, didn't care. Maybe I was shooting a neighborhood cat. Maybe I was turning into a little psychopath killing birds. But no, I was just shooting the clothesline pole, and I almost put my eye out. And at that, we will wish you a very merry McAllister McLeanmas 2. I think we've Christmased very hard.
As hard as I can, yeah.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. I hope you enjoy your time off with your friends and family. And please join us back in the new year, because we got a whole other bald movie year coming.
Yep.
Again, thanks for your support. Merry Christmas. See you next year, literally.